Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello, welcome to Contemplations, where we talk about something that isn't necessarily current news, and we go into it in depth, and quite often it is something that we believe is of interest and of value. And today we are looking at electoral systems and whether they determine results. I'm joined with Hugo.
Hello.
And Josh.
Hello. And so we'll be talking about voting systems. That's the overarching title. But we're going to be talking specifically about how they interact with party systems. So a voting system that might affect or produce some kind of party system, and then how a voting system can then affect political results in themselves. So actual policy or actual decisions, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we're going to be taking it a bit from a theoretical point of view, but also I know that you've prepared some examples. This is going to be interesting because this is something that you told me that you're really passionate about.
Yes,
that's kind of so that's something that's not usually happens usually with contemplations. One of us prepares the bulk of the work, and then we have a conversation about it. But now I prepare some notes, but you have a lot to say about it, so it's going to be a more lively conversation. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. So I suppose I may as well explain myself. So over the past 10 years or so, this is probably my most solidly held belief that the first past the post electoral system is terrible. And this is the system which, sorry if I'm stealing some of your notes here, I haven't actually had a look at what Hugo's got to say, but it's the system that's used in the UK. I think Canada uses it, the US and India are the main countries that use this system, but there are a series of flaws in it that I feel are inexcusable, and there are much better alternatives to it. Mm. And although there are plenty of defences of this system, I find that it doesn't really justify its use. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned some of the countries that use it, and actually there's a lot of countries that use it. There are a lot of them in Africa, and if you look at the world map, most of them are from the former British colonies.
That's what I was going to say. I didn't want to kind of go through a tedious list of every single one, but it's isn't it the common denominator? Yeah, it's kind of Southeast Africa, isn't it?
As you said, this is going to be particularly interesting, I think, for UK and US listeners. Mm-hmm. It's because they live under this system and they interact with it, but also for the others, it's also interesting to see how other systems work when it's not something that your country uses. So it's not like that's not relevant for some of our audience. Like it's, I think it's interesting for everyone.
For example, where Australia and New Zealand use more proportional voting systems, and they are obviously former Commonwealth countries that have abandoned first past the post for good reason, I feel.
And so I feel like often there is this kind of discussion in the US in particular, talking about that there's this two-party system and it's not locked in and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And I think maybe there's just my misconception, but the way I feel that this discussion often goes is something like, we have the Democrats, we have the Republicans, and we don't have a third party because no one is trying hard enough with a third party to actually be successful, right? And so the discussion goes something like, these two parties are so entrenched and so kind of locked in just because of that, because no one's actually seriously tried, or no one's put enough effort into a third party, and so all the third party attempts have not been serious enough.
Right? Yeah, and although
that's not true, right? And so
to be devil's advocate here, if you compare the UK and the US, there are a lot more third parties in the UK than there are in the US, despite using first past the post.
Yep.
And I think there is something to the fact that the main two parties are the focus of attention. And although that I believe that first past the post does promote the major two parties at the expense of the minor parties, so it does enforce this kind of partisan electoral system. That's not the right way of putting it, but you know what I'm trying to say. It does entrench that. I think that there is sufficient evidence from the UK to suggest that third parties can establish themselves even in first past the post, but it very much penalises them in terms of their representation. And I don't want to skip too far ahead, so carry on.
I just want to mention that there are interesting exceptions to how the first past the post system tends to work. Those exceptions are in the UK, and we can discuss them in more detail a bit later. But this is kind of interesting to talk about the exceptions like that that are in the UK, because it's a bit different from what's happening in the US. And so then the question becomes, okay, if I'm saying that it's not primarily the third party's fault that they haven't been successful, or it hasn't been for the lack of trying, then the question becomes, if other countries have more parties and have a different party system, like three parties or more parties, some countries have seven parties in the parliament, or eight or nine. I think most right now is in... I'm not sure whether I've seen more somewhere, but I know that the Czech Republic has nine parties in parliament, and some one country might have 10, I think. Sure. But I'm not sure. But that's just an illustration.
Germany has quite a few as well.
Yeah, but there's just an illustration of how many you can actually have in parliament. Like, it's not like a two-party system or a three-party system, which is something that I've heard also from American discussions, like talking about the two-party system. Okay, we want to replace it with a three-party system. Like, that's not
ambitious enough, in my view.
Sure, but like the point is that you can have loads of parties, and it's not like two or three is the options. Like, that's not.
I don't think
that works.
There are systems in existence that don't really place any limitation on the number of parties you can have, and also there are electoral systems that promote independent candidates, which I'm even more of a fan of, because I don't necessarily like the notion of political parties as a whole either. Although I find them pretty useful, I think people voting for the candidate that represents them makes far more sense. And I feel like people rely on political parties as a crutch to presume things about the candidates that stand for them that they may not otherwise... have thought if they actually looked into what the candidate they're voting for believes.
Yeah, it can be a useful shortcut for people who don't want to get involved in it, right?
I can understand.
Yeah, sure. And so, as you said, there's no limitations on the number of parties. So if some countries are suppressed or forbidden, then that's targeted, right? That's not okay. There can only be five parties. Like, that's not a thing. It's like you have. Like in Germany, for example, you can't have the Nazi party, right? Fine. Like that's not the same as saying there can be only five political parties. Like that's not a policy that would be in place anywhere, right? That's not how it goes. But when we're saying two or three or more party system, like what we're talking about is the result of an electoral system, and that's the interesting part, right?
Yeah.
That if you have an electoral system that works in some way, over time it's going to tend to produce some results. And those results will one of the manifestations of them will be how many parties you have and how powerful they have in comparison to the other parties. And that's where the discussion about first past the post comes in, because that is the strongest example of this process and what the results can be. Excuse me. And so that first example, the two-party system that is produced by the first past the post electoral system, and how is that actually produced, right? Because some people might not know how that process actually goes.
Sure.
So in the first round or in the first elections, you might have a lot of parties that are trying to win power, and let's say that we're looking for one winner of that party. So it might be a presidential election, might be an election for an MP or a congressman that is in one constituency. So we have one constituency and that elects one person to the parliament, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that kind of environment, where you can have the first past the post system, and that what it does is it's either it can say it can say whenever someone has more than 50%, then they get elected. But what it usually is that when whoever gets the most votes gets elected, right?
Yeah.
So it's just one person, one vote, and you can just like check the box with the candidate that you prefer, and then whoever gets the most, then that wins. Like that's simple, mm-hmm. right? And so. In that first round, in those first elections, you might have like 10 candidates or something, 10 from 10 political parties, and then you will have one candidate that's going to win that has like 20% of the vote or something,
mm-hmm.
and so that will represent 20% of the voters who actually voted for that person.
Yeah, and I do have a good example of that. So in 2015 in Northern Ireland, in the constituency of Belfast South, the winning candidate only won 24.5% of the vote, which raises some important questions about whether that person is really a legitimate representative of the people
yep.
in that constituency. Because yep. if you're operating under a representative democratic system, why would you want someone representing you that hasn't even got a quarter of mm-hmm. the votes? It seems to me absurd that the entire system is predicated on representation, yet the electoral system promotes people who more often than not don't have any degree yeah. of majority support.
And so if you have if that's what happens in the first elections, then some of the smaller candidates are going to say, just screw it, I'm not going to get involved in the next election, I'm not going to run. And the smaller parties are not going to get involved because they know they can't win. And so they're going to more likely to form an alliance of some mm-hmm. sort, or join some of the larger parties, some of the ones that received a lot more votes in the first election. And so that they'll kind of fall off. And then in the second election, that process kind of repeats, and the smaller parties that know that they can't really win because there's a couple more who are way more popular, then those get eliminated. Those just like fall by the side, because why would they get involved, right? And so mm-hmm. it's better to have at least some chance of influencing something by aligning yourself or with someone who might be more successful.
Yeah, the whole thing ties into tactical voting, mm-hmm. I feel, in that if you vote for someone who's roughly aligned with your interests mm-hmm. but is more likely to win, then it's still better for you in a tactical sense to use your vote in that way, yeah. even if perhaps they are a different version of your yeah. own beliefs. So quite often
that's from the position of the voter, right?
Yes. Yeah. But also from a party political mm-hmm. Standpoint as well, it makes sense not to challenge candidates in seats that are heavily contested. Mm-hmm. And you had this in the UK with UKIP and the Conservatives. They kind of had an informal coalition where they were like, well, we would rather have the Conservatives win than Labour. Therefore, we're not going to kind of split the vote mm-hmm. in these seats. Yeah. Therefore,
And splitting the vote is something that is very kind of key to first past the post, right?
Yeah, it's an inherent aspect yep. of it, and yep. something that I feel is very bad, because you kind of want a wide spectrum of mm-hmm. parties, and this allows you to be able to pressure parties that might be in perhaps a safe seat into representing you better. For example, you could live in a safe constituency like I did, where you have a Conservative representative who has never been deposed in my entire life, and it's been the same yep. person yep. who's been there for I don't live there anymore, obviously, but he was there for about, 25 years. Yep. And if people had a different strand of conservatism, well, they're not going to be able to promote it through that representative because it's been the same person for such a long time, and there's no pressure for him to change his yeah. views because he's in such a safe position that, well, he can just do what he wants. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to have his secure vote base. I think he was getting even like 60% of the vote at one point. So he's just like, well, I don't actually have to worry about these people. I can just rely on my secure voter yep. base, and then that's fine. And I feel that that's not very healthy for politics, because you need people on both sides putting forth arguments, and hopefully the representative would arrive at the better decision, but obviously we can't always rely on that. But at least in theory, that is what having more competition mm. would do.
And so in what it's called officially, this is called the spoiler effect, right? And mm-hmm. so that's when you have one candidate that is less popular than some other candidate, but then you a third candidate comes in and steals some votes from the top candidate, and so that means that less popular candidate then wins instant, mm-hmm. because that gets kind of splitting the vote, right? And so the spoiler effect is what that's called kind of officially, or in the area, in the jargon. And those, what you also mentioned before, is important, that we haven't defined yet, that people start voting strategically and tactically.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that it usually means that you have people who have certain preferences, or they have a list in their mind of like ranked preferences of mm-hmm. the candidates that are available. And then if that's how they feel, then honest voting means that they're going to vote accordingly, right? So if they have a choice out of the two, well, the one that is ranked higher in their heads, well, mm-hmm. that's going to get the vote. But then if they start being strategic, they start thinking about how other people are going to vote. And so if the electoral system is set up in some way, well, that can mean that if a group of people does something, it might be better for you to do something or something else rather than what you would do otherwise in a situation where you would be just thinking about, well, what's my preference? What's my honest yeah. preference?
People tend to vote for the candidate that they think is most likely to win and is relatively closely aligned mm-hmm. to what they believe. So they might not necessarily yeah, vote
in the first part.
That's right.
First past the post system. Sorry, but the strategic voting that applies to any voting system, and in each different voting system, it produces different pressures and different things that people do strategically, right? And so mm-hmm. this is the particular application of it that is produced in the first past the post system. So that's kind of interesting that this is how it works here, and it works actually very strongly. So it works very strongly in this way against these third party candidates, because those are being seen as having the potential to steal the vote. So the pressure on you is to vote for one of the two party candidates, because that's the safe choice, because if you vote third party, you might cause both of the ones that are broadly mm-hmm. aligned with you to lose.
There's a kind of phrase that's associated with this strategic voting, that if you vote for third party, you're basically voting for your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's seen in first past the post systems as a very stupid strategy to vote for perhaps a fringe candidate who has no chance of winning. And this also suppresses independence mm-hmm. and it entrenches political parties yep. That have the resources to field candidates and pay for large campaigns. Mm. So it also helps in winning over people who might be undecided by just throwing more money at the election, which is not a very democratic thing at all. Just spending the most money to get someone elected seems very bad, because it should be based on the actual policies and the credentials of the person you're electing.
And so what the third party usually then does in this kind of electoral system is that it herds the candidate that is large and closest to it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the summary of that problem, and that I think is very familiar to particularly American viewers. Like that's the discussion that they always have with each election that comes.
I imagine that the libertarians mm-hmm. are quite often finding themselves voting Republican.
Yep.
And they may not actually be comfortable with that because, you know, especially under George Bush, where he was starting foreign expeditions, shall we say, I imagine that was diametrically opposed to many of the libertarians' beliefs.
Right. Yeah, but that is how it applies to any two-party system. Under that first past the post electoral system. So it's not just an American thing. It's not a problem of American culture or of for the lack of trying of something. It's just a feature of that system, right? And the important question now is when we've talked a bit about the first past the post system is whether it is better to have a multi-party system. And so if yes, then is it then better to change the voting system from first past the post to something else, right? And you're gonna say yes, and I'm gonna say not necessarily.
Okay then.
Because then we can look at what different parties do, right? Mm-hmm. So in first past the post, you develop different parties over time, which behave differently and can react differently to what the public wants than what you get in countries where you have proportional representation, where you have any electoral system that is proportionally representative. Let me give you that example. So right now you have the Democratic Party in the U.S. that does certain things around around Biden, and mm-hmm. it has some kind of fringe or side parts of it that are differently aligned, like the Squad and others maybe, mm-hmm. So these things are present in the party, like the different little pockets of influence, and that kind of fuels a discussion within that party over what it's going to be and how it's going to change going forward. And if you look at the Democratic Party from, I don't know, 20 years ago, it's a very different party than it is now. And the Republican Party, I think, even more so, right?
Yeah.
So those two parties are almost incomparable with the parties that they used to be only 20 years, for example. That's not such a long time.
But in the case of the Democrats, mm-hmm. it seems to me that in many ways that it's a coalition of people that otherwise would not be working together if it wasn't for the political system. Like the progressives and the kind of neoliberal types, mm-hmm. and they're just as much at their own each other's throats even. Mm-hmm. And then they are perhaps Republicans because they're so ideologically separated mm-hmm. in the kind of corporate Dems and the kind of progressives that there's not really much they can agree upon a lot of the time.
And so this is exactly my point though. So you have this kind of big mm-hmm. tent party that there's a lot of influences, there's a lot of discussion or fights or whatever going on inside the party, and that's not how political parties usually operate in multi-party systems, in representative systems. So where you have a lot of smaller parties, what they do is usually they have a party that is kind of very closely tied together. I'm generalizing, so there's going to be exceptions, and two, it's not going to be completely true mm-hmm. everywhere. So just take that with a grain of salt.
It does make intuitive sense, though, if they're smaller, I'm just talking
to the audience. Like, not take me too closely with my word, because like what I'm saying is a trend, is a tendency. Mm-hmm. It's not what applies 100% in every case. And so you will tend to have smaller parties that are maybe a single issue party, or that are, you know, very closely ideologically aligned, and multiple parties like that will then form larger coalitions to form the government or form the opposition, and that's an important thing. An important feature of that is that those parties rarely change. That if that you have, what happens much often is that you parties are created and parties kind of are not destroyed but kind of disbanded, and they cycle through the parliament much faster. Often in multi-party systems, you have some big parties that are a bit more long-lasting or that have been there for longer, and then you have some parties that are smaller or that just came in last election and then probably going to be gone by like two elections from now and things like that, right? And so you have a different process through which these ideological differences get organized on the debt system. So it's not like you wouldn't have any input of different ideologies and different points of view in that system, in the first past the post system. You do, but it happens in a different way than in the multi-party systems. It just happens on a kind of hidden level, like it's a bit further away from the actual voter, but it happens nonetheless, right? And the parties that change, the big two parties that you have, they change a lot, and they change in response to what the public wants broadly, right? So they're usually not the first to do it. Usually it's the public first that kind of calls for something or is very loud about something, right? And then the party slowly can say like, okay, so we have to promote this now because we want to kind of keep our position, right? And so that's what they do. That's what they tend to do. And they change a lot. If you look at it over time, over a long period of time, they're not the same party that they used to be. And that's not what happens in multi-party systems. You have parties that are created, parties that are disbanded, and they rarely change election to election. They rarely change what they're going to focus on and what they promote and how they approach this thing based on what the electorate wants.
My main kind of point here would be that in that kind of system, the power rests on the party to change, and there may be aspects which may be very popular with the voters, but the party is unwilling to compromise about. And in a more proportional system, the power rests more with the voters, and if there's a refusal for their current party to change in a way that they would like, they can perhaps vote for someone who is similar, and they actually have more of a chance of getting in. And through having more competition with other parties, there's more incentives to actually listen to what voters want. And in parties shrinking and rising with their growing or decreasing popularity, that is a sign of something that is good in a multi-party system. And I think promoting just a couple of parties based on their ability to win elections, that's not a good thing.
But so, what you said there last about their ability to win the elections, where they do that by gathering votes. And if you have two parties, they need half of the votes because the other parties are small, right? And so, so what they still need to do, what they're still trying to do, is be more popular than the other big party. And that's what produces that pressure. So you have the same pressures that you talked about that are in the multi-party systems, but you have them elsewhere, right? You still have that party that is competing against the other party. Like, they still, like, at least to the public, they don't like each other, right? And so they will have those kind of changes, and those changes will happen much quicker than in the multi-party systems. Those changes within that party, right? So you will have much more changes within the party and much more reactions to what's going on around in the public and elsewhere within those parties. And to that, correspondingly to that, you will have those changes among the parties rather than within the parties in those multi-party
systems. Is that not just a product of it being a homogenized kind of collective of left and right in a two-party system? It's kind of, broadly speaking, you've got the left and it's just a very broad spectrum of beliefs, and the same is true on the right as well. And the fact that they're changing is just because they're such a broad church of various ideas that they've kind of got to move their positions around. Whereas if you've got a wide spectrum of political parties to choose from, they don't necessarily have to change as much because people already have the choices that are present.
Exactly, but that's what I'm saying. If those parties change like that and change a lot inside, then that produces the result that you want. That produces that change that you want. That additional choice. So it then matters less than you have only a choice of two parties, because those two parties are in effect different parties than the two that you had the last elections, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that change is real and is produced, but it's produced elsewhere. And so I don't think it's necessarily more valuable for you to be able to elect someone from another party, rather than when we're not talking about what those people actually promote and what they stand for, right? And so if you have like five smaller parties and their candidates are all about the same thing, then that's not a better thing than if you have one big party and you have five candidates from that big party and each of them says a different thing, right? Or each of them promote a different thing. Like that, like you have that same political process and deliberation, let's say, or whatever, that happens all the same, but it happens elsewhere and it produces the result that you might want or you might not want, but it produces similar results, but just on different, mm-hmm. in a different venue.
I think in practice, though, in first-past-the-post systems, representatives don't necessarily have to listen to what their voters actually want some of the time. And a lot of the times they actually vote directly in opposition to the interests of the people they elect. And I feel like...
Right, do you think that happens less in multi-party systems?
Yeah, because there's a greater chance, particularly if there's proportional representation, that they can lose their seat and there's greater accountability. Whereas...
But there's not a larger chance that we lose their seat. Because there is this other big party. Like often in multi-party systems, you have one big party that kind of dominates the field, mm-hmm. and then you have a lot of like smaller parties that could progressively very smaller.
People understand that they're not wasting their vote if they vote for another candidate that perhaps is, say...
But you have the second party.
Yeah, but they might still rather vote for the person that they're disillusioned with than the second party.
I know. I understand the drawback, but that person, like if you have those two parties will broadly correspond with like the two halves of the electorate, because otherwise you wouldn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
And so those who will be the decisive voters are not the ones that will always vote for one party or the other, but the ones that are undecided and they flip, mm-hmm. election to election. And so if that's the case, well then they need to be very responsive to what those few voters do. Those two candidates, because that candidate actually can lose the election much easier to the other big party,
mm-hmm.
if it's actually close to 50-50 than in a multi-party system where you can have one party that has 30% and then the second party having 15% and then like that like dropping off very quickly, and so you only have that one party and that party's candidate can be quite sure that they're not going to lose whatever 20% of the vote, right?
The issue is that if you have elections decided by the people who cannot make a decision, mm-hmm. and are probably, the people on the fence that probably don't know much about politics.
Well, you're making assumptions that are not.
I am making assumptions, but it is also true that if you haven't
those people that are not interested in politics just don't vote.
Well, people do vote because they're told that it's very important, but they're more susceptible, these people who are more apathetic to politics, mm-hmm. to the kind of tricks that politicians play to get elected.
I wouldn't want to go like into this direction.
Yeah,
because I think that
it is a bit of a tangent.
No, it's like not anything against you, but I think that these things apply to any system and every system, mm-hmm. and that in each system it will produce a slightly different results, but those same forces will be present in every system. And so when we're talking about these kind of flaws of representation and democracy, we're having a completely different discussion than of different party systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, as I said, like those are present everywhere, and so like yes, we can talk about those, but I think that we're steering away a little bit from.
Yeah,
from
sorry. Do carry on.
I didn't mean to cut you off, so we can
no,
really,
no, sorry.
But
I've thrown you off now.
Right. So I wanted to talk about a bit. Just to bring it back to, mm-hmm. what we were talking about before, in two-party systems, you can also have new parties being created all the time, and that's kind of a question of culture, right? Of, mm-hmm. like whether people are really like into it and entrepreneurial and really like are enthusiastic about creating new parties.
It's about the political environment, isn't it?
Yeah. And so you still, even in a two-party, even in the first past the post system, you can have new parties being created all the time. That like no one said that can't happen. The thing is that those parties are much less likely to become successful and to actually challenge those big two parties, right? That's the thing. It's not about them not being created. It's about them never becoming actually relevant.
Sure.
And so you can see that that's what I took as an illustration here. This is the 2015 election, national election in the UK, and the top half of it is the vote share from the total number of votes. So how people actually voted, if you take all of them, and then the parliamentary seats. In the bottom half is what they got in parliament, who actually got in, who actually became an MP or a congressman in the US. And so this is, you can see that there's some big outliers. So both Labour and Conservative got much more seats than they were, quote unquote, supposed to, or that's what their vote share was. And particularly the UKIP was... Yeah, that got 12.6% and got one.
It was one seat, yeah.
One seat, yeah. And you can see it all the way down, fourth from the bottom, like almost invisible, even though it was the third biggest party, right? And so you could, like that's quite strong. And then you can see the opposite effect as well. The Scottish National Party had 4.7%, but it got way more seats, so you got 8.6% of the seats.
Yeah, and for kind of food for thought, in Scotland itself, the Scottish National Party only got 50% of the vote, but they won 95% of the seats in Scotland. So that seems pretty bad, but only half the people in Scotland wanted to be represented by them, but they had almost a 100% share of the seats.
And so to actually explain what is happening there to people who might not be familiar with British politics, the Scottish National Party that's what happens to it because it is a regional party, right? Mm-hmm. So it is only in Scotland, it is present only in Scotland, and in Scotland it has slightly the majority in most areas.
Yeah.
Right? The majority is not too big, but it has the majority in almost all areas. And so what that does is that it gives them a lot of seats because that majority gets turned into effective 100% in that particular area, and you kind of count all those areas together, and that produces a lot of seats there because basically the whole region of Scotland is voting for the Scottish National Party. So that's why they go up. And in comparison, the UK Independence Party had 12.6% in the national vote, but if you look at where people voted for it, it was basically everywhere in England.
Yeah, it's a bit spread out.
Exactly, but basically nowhere in England did it have the majority to win.
Sure.
And so basically all those votes got kind of discarded.
Wasted votes, yeah.
Yeah. And so only in one constituency you had UKIP actually getting a majority, and that's the one candidate.
I would like to make a point about the Scottish National Party in their elections in Scotland, because before they kind of rose to electoral prominence in Scotland, the seats were traditionally Labour, and this kind of transferred after Tony Blair to the Scottish National Party because they weren't big fans of Blair, which I certainly have in common. But it was very much more a two-party system. It's just that in Scotland, the Scottish National Party has taken over from the traditional Labour voters.
Right.
So it's not necessarily that the system has allowed this third party. It's just entrenched a different party in its place.
And if we say that this is a two-party system, that what you just said is very important, because if you take the SNP and just add it on to Labour, then that becomes almost the same as the Conservatives in this particular election, right? And in most elections it's like that, I think. And so you have those two big parties being effectively equal to one another, even though one of them is split along those regional lines.
Sure.
Right. And so now I would like to turn shift gears for a little bit, and to to ask the question, how does the voting system actually affect the culture where it is, right? And so I was thinking a little bit about the effects that first past the post produces in the broader kind of society. And I think it's close to like a sports match, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when it's for one figure, like the presidential elections, right? And so then it depends on the broader societal kind of situation and political cleavages, but either you have that as a good spirit competition or a completely kind of vicious battle between like good and evil, right? And so that depends on the kind of spirit that is, whether that sports competition is happening, whether there's goodwill or not. Sure. And so if everyone's just fine and there's like very few tensions, which almost never happens, that this will have this good spirit competition, just like a friendly match between and friendly clubs, whatever. But then if you have like people who completely hate each other, that devolves into like these like football hooligans.
That's
like,
exactly what I was thinking.
Messing with one another, right?
It seems from a psychological sense very counterintuitive to have this kind of partisan mm-hmm. system where you have one group versus another, and it's very clear what characteristics are of group membership and things like this, and it seems set up to promote kind of in-group favoritism and out-group anger, I suppose, but among many other negative things. So it seems to me to play off of the human tendency mm-hmm. to be very favorable to the in-group and very exclusionary and hostile to an out-group. And it seems very counterproductive to approaching elections in a very thought out way mm. when you've got it set up to be very highly emotive. I think particularly Americans might be very familiar with the environment around elections, and particularly the most recent presidential election, things seemed very hostile between the two parties. Yep. And I think that could be a product of the fact that it's playing off of this psychological mechanism that makes people favour their own group against the other. And when there are such clear distinctions between two large groups, it also means that the perceived threat is high because the numbers are comparable to one another.
Mm-hmm. And so what I think it's important to mention as well, beyond these negative influences, is that this environment also produces identity. It causes identities to be formed in people. People mm-hmm. get to pick their team. People get to be part of something bigger and be part of something that where they can win or they can lose or they can have an impact like that, right? So it's kind of the heroic battle. And you get that identity being very rewarding in some sense, that it is important for people to mm-hmm. have that. And so this, even though it might be unhealthy in a lot of ways, as you said, it can also be something that is very beneficial for people in that they can have that identity, right? And that they can create that.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yes, and I just wanted to contrast that with some of the proportional systems mm-hmm. where you have the typical feature of that is kind of low loyalty, is that voters are not aligned. I'm not really tied to the party. They're not really interested in those parties. They just like Google them and figure out, okay, which one is closest, but they often don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And no, if you're looking at what's supposed to be constituencies, well, then few people actually know who their candidates are or know how to reach them or talk to them when they need something or something like that. And that's a feature that is very much more present in systems that have very clear lines between different areas where you have one person representing it, right? And so that's in England in particular, you've got MPs that represent one particular area of
sure.
Or in Britain and represent one particular area, and the area is often quite small, and so you will have people who live in that area that will have that relation to that MP just by looking at what that MP does and whether it represents well that area. And so whenever they don't like it, they usually like send letters or emails or something like that to that MP. And that doesn't happen too much in proportional systems, just because everyone is kind of anonymous and there's no relations like that formed. Right?
It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, though, I feel, because if you take, for example, something known as single transferable vote, it has larger constituencies than there would be otherwise. Let's take the example of the UK, because it's the one I'm most familiar with. But what would be three separate constituencies ordinarily would be one larger constituency with three MPs instead. And rather than perhaps one person being more tied to a specific area, they can be more tied to representing the views of the people that voted for them in that area. And this also is good for people redressing grievances with their Member of Parliament, because they have a bit more of a selection with people who might otherwise be sympathetic to their cause. So if they have a problem, they can approach someone who is more likely to be politically aligned with them. And say you're living in a constituency under first past the post where it's a safe seat for a specific party, but you vote for the minority party. And even though you might be part of perhaps 35-40% of the voters that support this losing party, your views may not be heard by your elected MP because they might not agree with them. And it might be more difficult to get this, to form this kind of beneficial relationship with your representative. Whereas when you have a larger constituency, you have more choice over who you can contact about representing your views.
So I'll address some of that, but but also this was kind of a preview of tomorrow's discussion
that
we're going to have, where we're going to talk more specifically about different options for voting systems, of electoral systems, and we're going to judge which one is better at which and which one is worse at which. So that is going to be interesting. But to what you said, I think that it's important to kind of say that yes, that can be the case, but also if you have kind of more choice on who to contact, you might not bother to do it. And if that's going to be a scale, I think. So if you take that to the extreme, even if you broaden that constituency to the entire nation, and you have one constituency, you have proportional system in that one constituency.
I believe like Holland use that.
I'm not sure about possible.
I'm pretty sure.
So then you have that eliminated completely. You can you could write to any MP, but you're not going to write to any of them because you don't know any of them, and none of them is supposed to represent you and your kind of local area, right? And so the broader it's going to be, the more alienated it's going to be from the actual voters, and the less comfortable the voters will feel actually interacting with the MPs, right? I'm not saying that that's completely true in what you were proposing, but it's going to be more true than in the systems where the constituencies are as small as possible, right? And so that's just a trade-off that you need to make at some point, because if you can gain some things, but you will lose others in the process.
I feel like if people have a legitimate grievance, though, the barrier of simply looking up who they might be able to talk to isn't a very large one. And especially having someone who's more receptive is more important than simply having more choice or it being less direct. And generally speaking, actually, to MPs' credits, they're normally very good at responding to people. And even though they may not respond personally, they may have someone on their team to say, oh, thanks for contacting us, been made aware of the issue and things like that. So that's
our experience from the first part of the post system, though.
Yeah, but it's...
No, but that's what I'm saying, right? Yeah. Because you're presuming that they're going to respond in the same way, and the relationship is going to be broadly the same if the constituencies get broadened and if there's more choice in who to contact. But that's not necessarily the case, I think, right? You can feel like that would be the case because that's what it is now under the first past the post, but that's not how it's necessarily going to turn out. And the pressure, the tendencies there are for the opposite.
I feel like I don't necessarily agree with that, but to play devil's advocate against my own position, I feel like if what might be a problem is if there was actually a member of the government in your constituency, then people would be far more likely to contact them than perhaps someone else.
Maybe not. They might be intimidated.
Well, if that's a problem on them. We can't form a political system based on people.
No, you can, because you can predict it, right? So if you predict that some people will be intimidated and would rather not contact a person that they feel is too important, right? That you can kind of mitigate for that. And that's what different systems do. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow as well. What different electoral systems can actually address different problems and mitigate for the different things that are different for each society, right? Mm-hmm. So that you can produce a kind of a similar result, a similarly valid result, just by using different methods, just because the start point is different. And we get into more of it tomorrow. I know that this was a bit of a confusing explanation, but that's we're gonna make it more approachable tomorrow. So I want you to move on a little bit to just saying that in a proportional system, then if you have multiple parties, if you have whatever 8 parties in parliament, mm-hmm. you still have a coalition and the opposition that are created, right? And so because they need more than 50% to pass things in parliament and to actually be effective. Yeah. And so you will have those two tribes being formed, and those will kind of simulate that two-party system. And it's not going to be the same, but it's going to be something that has the same, you know, structure or a similar sure. structure.
Would I just be able to add a little caveat?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Although there might be these two-party systems, it's not going to be exactly the same under first past the post, because they have the ability to kind of move around mm-hmm. Depending on the issue at hand. So
yes.
they don't have the same political party whip kind of keeping them in line with the 50% consensus.
Yes.
So it might actually result in perhaps different mm-hmm. Voting behavior in parliament because there's less of a centralization of power within these specific sides.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to focus on is to ask why these things are created in the first place. So if you have 5 parties in parliament, and you could have them being relatively independent and trying to form and trying to kind of see who can support each proposal, but they don't do it like that. Don't do it like that. They agree up front whether they're going to vote together or not, and then if something serious is going on which they really don't like, that they can dissent from it because they're their own mm-hmm. political party, of course. But so why does that happen? Why do they do that up front? I think that it starts with the fundamental, you know, truth that it's easiest to have a two-way debate on a single thing, right? Rather than to have more way debate. So if you have something, it's much easier to have to just have a discussion where there's two sides and nothing else, because the delineation is very clear between those two sides, and it's not confusing as to where anyone stands or what anyone supports, right?
I think it just comes down to human psychology at the end of the day, in that it's more difficult to keep track of three different people's competing opinions, whereas when it's two, you can kind of characterize it more easily in your own head. And especially when you're talking about perhaps complex political issues, mm-hmm. it makes the issue even harder than otherwise.
And I think it's exactly psychology. And it's because in a two-way debate, you have one choice. You have A versus B. Like, that's one kind of, mm-hmm. kind of line, right? And then in a three-way debate, you have three choices, like A, B, C, and you have 1, 2, 3, right? So you need to kind of have in mind those three relations between the three. And if you have 4, then you have 6 choices, right? Right? So you have 6 relations that you have to keep in mind. Well, when you have 5, then you already have 24 choices. 24 relations between each pair.
Sure.
Right? And so that gets very messy, and that gets very hard to track. And so it's an instinct, I think, to reduce that to that two-way debate, because then there's only one thing that you have to keep track of.
Sure. I think that is a fair point. It does make it more difficult, but at the same time, I think the focus should be on the issue at hand rather than the positions mm-hmm. of the political parties. And if people focus more on whether they are in favour of the current motion in the legislature, then it might simplify it more and they won't necessarily have to keep track of what other people are doing. Yep. And even if it is more complicated, that might actually be a good thing, because then it means they're not voting based on what other people are doing, but actually on the issue at hand.
No, I agree that I also think that it would produce better results broadly if that kind of more varied discussion was taking place, but that's not the tendency. And I think that the tendency is because the two-way debate is the most low effort one, right? People are effort minimizing individuals, and so that will just naturally happens.
I think to kind of counter my own point, if members of the public are watching perhaps a debate in the legislature, then it may be more difficult if they don't have the expertise required to follow what all of these different competing groups. So it might make politics more inaccessible for the average person, which may not be desirable. But if you keep the kind of view contained to the legislature itself, I feel like it could actually be beneficial.
And so If this is kind of true, if it often gets reduced to the kind of two-way debate, well then you can have one argument for the two-party system, for the first past the post system, that doesn't take away from the other arguments, of course, but that one argument could be that if you have that two-party system that is simulated anyway, then you might as well have it officially, which is not necessarily what I think, but this can be like one thing you can say for it, right? Just why pretend that something else is going on if it's not? And so I think the last kind of thing that I want to touch upon really quickly before we conclude this is the role of the agenda setter. So that person who decides what is going to be voted upon and how things are going to be conducted and organized, that is very important, right? And in some ways, the more complicated a system gets, then a more of the larger the role of the agenda setter is, because then they are the ones who are saying what's going to happen when and where and under what circumstances, because that has to be, you know, accounted for at some point, right? And so to the point where you can't have it happen automatically, you will have to have people there to decide, and those people will effectively become kind of small dictators of their particular area of conduct, and they will then decide based on what they want, and they can skew the results just by framing the situation differently, right? And so that it's important to keep in mind that whenever we talk about any of these systems, it is always necessary to look at that function of the agenda setter. I don't know if there's anything you would like to add to that.
I think that's a fair point. I mean, it's going to make things more complicated, don't get me wrong. I just feel like the complications are worth putting up with for the benefits that I see in this kind of system.
But I didn't mean just like in proportional versus first past the post. What I meant was also that, like, if you're voting on something in parliament, for example, like a different situation, right? If you're voting on something in parliament, well, who decides what's going to be voted upon, right? And in what order, and if it's going to be late at night, so no one's going to come in, right? And things like that, right? So that's a very key position that you can have in that system.
I think, at least in the case of the UK, it's mainly the government, but they also allow for other parties to submit their own issues to be discussed, but that's upon the discretion of the government, and they have these open slots that many people compete for, and they're notoriously competitive, where they have members of parliament camping out in parliamentary offices to get to the kind of office as quickly as possible to get a discussion on an issue. So it's not necessarily an ideal system, but I think it works a bit different with the House speakers and such in the US, doesn't it?
No, like, of course, this was an example of like in a different setting, but it's it's important to keep in mind whether the role of the agenda set is something that comes into the discussion or not. Like, it might not.
Sure. Right. My main reason for bringing that up is that the executive is introducing many of the motions in the UK, whereas it's more legislature focused in the US because there's a greater separation of powers than in the UK, which the members of the executive are derived from the legislature.
Yep. And so just to conclude what we've talked about this episode, electoral systems can affect your political results in quite significant ways, and they can, but at the same time they can affect them in multiple different ways, and those different ways can actually go against each other, right? So when I was talking about what culture it produces, or what happens inside those parties as compared to between different parties, like those are different things that might go against something like the spoiler effect, and mm-hmm. and so these all things can go different ways and you don't know whether they cancel out or whether they're going to support each other or not, and so you can't really say that for one side of the political debate or another one system is better or worse, right? You can't say that first past the post is better for the progressives and proportional representation is better for conservatives, something like that. Like it's not like that, because it produces many different mm-hmm. Effects that can go against each other, and it depends on how strong they are and the other circumstances that you have in your country.
I would say that the main two parties do have a strong incentive not to reform first past the post, because I know, at mm-hmm. least in the UK...
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true, yeah.
Yeah, in the UK, the main two parties are very resistant mm-hmm. to this, because they both stand to benefit yep. from it, and therefore it's very difficult to change. And I know there mm-hmm. was an attempt under the Liberal Democrats, which was kind of a... kind of dispassioned thing, because the Conservatives only allowed them to advocate for something known as AV+, which is an electoral system which they were kind of lukewarm about, so they yep. kind of didn't really want it.
Yep.
And that therefore this kind of reform didn't really go through, and the Conservatives have used that now to say, well, we've voted on electoral, like, changing the system, therefore why would we do it again? We, even though it's something that no one was happy with in the first place.
It was a smart move.
It was clever, yeah.
So you'll definitely have those two parties that are entrenched in the first past the post system. You'll have them lobbying against it changing. But there's no kind of political side or side of the political debate that sure. would inherently mm-hmm. benefit from one system or another. Like that's not like,
it's not really a partisan issue,
exactly,
because you have both. I remember in the UK you had both UKIP, which is like a centre-right party, and the Green Party, which is kind of a quite left-wing party, both advocating mm-hmm. for more proportional representation yep. in Parliament, even though they're kind of diametrically opposed ideologically to one another. They were advocating on the same issue, so I think that serves mm-hmm. to prove your point. Mm-hmm.
And so also you have your election results and political results that depend on other things, it's not all determined by the voting system. You can have demographics and regional differences, like that regional difference with the Scottish National Party that mm-hmm. produces wildly disproportionate results that you would have otherwise if there was no kind of cultural or political difference between Scotland and England, right? If there was no kind of national separation like that, there's no national identity, you wouldn't have that. So that fact that you have one kind of voting bloc that is divided into separate identities, then that produces results that you wouldn't have otherwise, right? So you don't have that in America. You don't have kind of the, I don't know, whatever, Yankee Party like this. I don't know, but it's like that's a product of this kind of circumstance, mm-hmm. and you can have it with demographics, for example, like age, whatever, race, if there's racial conflicts and things like that. So that can all go into it. And so if you say that, for example, regional differences like that are not kind of genuine enough for you to have the results that you would see as valid, you'd have to, you know, tailor your electoral system to mitigate for those to get the genuine result, right? And then you get into murky territory around definitions and around agenda setting power, and that becomes very important. Like where is the clash important enough that you're going to want to mitigate it through an electoral system or something like that, right? That's something that you will have very concentrated kind of power source of, like, deciding where elections are actually going to go
You mean like as in the electoral boundaries being changed if a different system was brought in?
So for example, if you had a country where there's two races that have had some difficult history, so that can quite antagonistic towards each other, and you have one party that broadly is representing the one race, and the other that is the other party represents the other race, and you can say, okay, I don't consider this result, this party system, to be legitimate enough because I would like it to be based on political differences and not racial differences, and so I'm going to design my electoral system so that it mitigates against that and it prevents those two parties being entrenched according to those races.
Yeah,
so that's a decision that someone has to make at some point. Mm-hmm. to say that this is not a good enough result for me, and this is not genuine for me, this is not a genuine democracy because they decide based on racial affiliations and not political differences, right? And so those kind of things that then it gets very kind of shaky what you do and why and what's your justification and what's your basis on doing that. Mm-hmm.
I think in the case of places that use first past the post, they're all representative democracies, and I think the most plausible case in opposition to changing the electoral system would be that the representatives are not representative of the people's views, mm-hmm. which seems to be a central part of our currently entrenched political system.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's something I would like to mention as like a little detour, but in the case of the US presidential election in 1992, a good kind of case study for people would be the candidate of Ross Perot mm-hmm. splitting the Republicans' vote, even though between the Republican and Ross Perot, who was an independent,
yep.
They would have won if there was a preferential voting system. Mm-hmm. The Democratic candidate ended up winning mm-hmm. because of the split in the vote.
Yep.
And this is a case where the person who was elected was less representative of the people they're meant to be representing. Mm-hmm. And it seemed very counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And that's something I would suggest people to actually go away and look at if they want to see perhaps a more egregious example of first past the post creating a poor outcome for people.
Yeah. I mean, and it depends, right? You can say it's a poor outcome, but then you can have other criteria that say that it's not such a bad outcome, or it is. I don't know, and we'll explore that in tomorrow's episode because we're going to be talking about different systems and different criteria for assessing those systems, mm-hmm. and that's going to be fun. And so I agree with you that this doesn't seem fair, and this probably not fair. So okay, yeah. So let's end it there today, and we'll get back to you tomorrow and talk about.
Thank you very much for watching. Make sure to check out the stuff on the site. And make sure to tune in tomorrow.
Yeah, that's lotuscds.com.
That's the one.
Right.
Goodbye.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.